These people have a hole in their soul that they're trying to fill. And if that becomes your driver to obtain personal fulfillment through achievement, you can never achieve enough. I didn't see many happy, well-adjusted Nobel laureates. Don't be a victim. There's a lot of different roles you can play. In a sense, we're all in the middle of the hero's journey. Either that or we're NPCs. If we're not NPCs and we're real adult humans, we are all living through some form of the hero's journey, in which we will go through a period of trial and then come back with new wisdom. There are various forces that wish to position you as a victim. Artificial intelligence is not intelligence. It can mimic intelligence. Does it have a soul? This is, do androids dream of electric sheep, getting back to Blade Runner? Can we replicate something like a soul?
You're kind of asking the question, does the caterpillar maintain a level of awareness of itself once it becomes a butterfly?
It seems in a strange way that everything that I've done has led up to this moment in time, but professionally, except for breeding my horses and being a small farmer and a carpenter. But putting that aside, when I was a graduate student, I was very focused on gene therapy. I wanted to be a gene therapist, and I had the scores in my graduate examinations. Having already completed 2 years of medical school, I kind of pegged my graduate entrance exams and was able to select pretty much anywhere I wanted to go. And so I got into what was then the top university complex for researching gene therapy, particularly using retroviruses. And there were two main laboratories there, those of Ted Friedman, who's the pediatrician that originally came up with the idea of using genetic material to try to cure pediatric patients with genetic disease, and that of Dr. Inder Verma, who had been trained under David Baltimore, the Nobel laureate, and had become a full professor quite rapidly, I think by before the age of 30 or thereabouts, at the Salk Institute, where he ran a very large postdoctoral lab in the laboratories of molecular virology. I went to Inder's lab and focused on retroviral vectors, use of retroviruses to insert genes for gene therapy purposes, and focused on a specific aspect of that, which was how RNA is assembled into retroviruses, which was a big question at the time because the retroviral assembly was inefficient. So it took a lot of work and a lot of cells to make a small amount of retroviruses for gene therapy purposes. And in pursuing that research, I had a series of discoveries or developments having to do with the structure of RNA, the delivery of RNA into cells, the characteristics of RNA necessary to allow it to be made in the test tube, let's say, in vitro, and then turned into protein after it's delivered into cells. And having made those developments and discoveries in large-scale manufacturing of pure RNA and how to do it, et cetera, I found myself suddenly, inadvertently, having a gene delivery system, a non-viral gene delivery system, using a non-traditional molecule, RNA, and in a laboratory that was focused on viral vector gene therapy. So I was suddenly swimming upstream in a big way. And in that laboratory, the postdoc next to me had some odd discoveries. Dan St. Louis was his name. And using retroviruses to deliver foreign genes into mice. And that was that the proteins would stop being produced after about 2 weeks. And I was the one that figured out that this was because the mice were generating an immune response against the foreign protein. And now in retrospect, that's obvious. But at the time, that was a almost heretical to say that, because it meant that the whole field of gene therapy, this growing new domain, was going to have some huge challenges. Because if you're the child with cystic fibrosis and a mutation in your CFTR, your immune system doesn't know that that is a bad protein. It knows that it's your protein. And so if you give the normal CFTR protein as a gene and it's producing this proper CFTR protein, you're not going to cure the cystic fibrosis. You're going to generate an immune response against that novel protein. So for me, this was a rude awakening. The career that I thought I had suddenly vanished before my eyes. I knew this was not going to work. And fortunately, I had a background in vaccinology, both in influenza and in HIV vaccine development from my earlier years. And I just had the brainstorm that we could use this new non-viral technology that I had blundered into, basically, trying to do other things, to generate an immune response. We could use it for vaccines, and this was going to be the easiest application rather than trying to cure muscular dystrophy or any of the childhood diseases. And so that led to an initial patent application at the Salk Institute, which led to a firestorm of basically internecine warfare, fighting between the university lawyers and the Salk lawyers, and who gets to be credit, get credit for this, and whose name is going to be on it, and blah, 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 blah. The upshot of which is that I ended up with a nervous breakdown and PTSD, and left the graduate program having completed my qualifying exams with a master's degree. And this manuscript on delivering RNA into cells and all of the things that's necessary to make it work. I then joined a startup called Vital, which was right across the street from the Salk. And there I brought over all my reagents and my protocols and kit. They let me set up a skunk works, and there, together with other scientists, we reduced it to practice, showing that you could use this to mount an immune response in mice, initially against HIV proteins and then influenza proteins after I left. And that then got sold to Merck and became a big deal, but mostly focused on the use of DNA, not RNA, because people couldn't make the RNA. They couldn't manufacture it. It turned out that I had certain skills that I developed from doing this that other people couldn't just replicate. So it kind of sat there until the patents expired. And then they got picked, that field got picked up again, funded by DARPA and the German government. That created Moderna and BioNTech. I also have a really strong background in biodefense, because I, after I left academia, I joined a company that had just acquired the contract for all biodefense related product development for the US military.
Called Dynamo. Oh, wow. So I'm assuming you probably needed a clearance at that point.
Yeah, I actually got my clearance a little later. I've been secret cleared when I was working for another Beltway bandit. I was, as an associate director, medical director there, I was involved in virtually all the key products: smallpox vaccine, plague vaccine, the equine encephalitis vaccines, and I mentioned anthrax tularemia. All these things were part of the portfolio, both drugs, antibodies, and vaccine products. So I have a pretty good understanding of that domain. but then was laid off after the NIH took over from the DOD the entire portfolio as part of Tony Fauci's kind of power grab in which he got his big bonus and so much more money. And I've also worked for regulatory affairs specialty companies down in Rockville. I worked for the woman who actually was the FDA reviewer for AZT. So I've written and many INDs, interacted with the FDA in many meetings, worked for companies that were involved in clinical research, particularly for vaccines, completed a postgraduate fellowship at Harvard Medical School in development and international clinical development. I've worked for a Bill and Melinda Gates funded company called Aris Global TB Vaccine Foundation. This is one of the early ones. I worked for a company that might be more familiar to those in the UK, Solvay Pharmaceuticals, company out of the Netherlands and Belgium that I was working on a very large U.S. government contract for influenza vaccine development manufacturing. Managed about $150 million budget there. And I've then become a consultant to many companies, often at the chief science or chief executive officer level, doing various things, including business development, consulting support, advice, and writing grants and contracts and leading large contract teams. I've become pretty skilled in building teams to solve complicated problems for the government. And it was in that context that I've been at the forefront of many of these outbreaks, more recently Zika and influenza, and was at the tip of the spear for the West African Ebola outbreak, where I supported a company called New Link Genetics that had acquired the Ebola vaccine from Public Health Canada, and they decided they didn't have the chops to carry that forward, and so I got it sold off to Merck. That's now the licensed Ebola vaccine. So I've been in this business a long time, and it's odd to be accused of being a anti-vaccine specialist when I've spent 30 years as a vaccine specialist. First off, it's not my first rodeo. I guess that's probably an American expression. It's not my first rodeo as a whistleblower. I kind of destroyed my academic career when I spoke to the press quite a bit about what I knew concerning the death of Mr. Jesse Gelsinger, the young man that died from Jim Wilson at the University of Pennsylvania overdosing him with an adenovirus. The vector in gene therapy. And the press was very confused about that. And I had deep insider knowledge about what had taken place. And I was in advanced training in bioethics at the time and told my mentor what I knew about that. And he said I had a moral obligation to speak out. And so I took him at his word and destroyed my career, basically. But I also learned that you can follow your heart and your soul and speak truth to power and survive. The forces that be deployed all their propaganda tools, but they didn't expect the podcast.
No, the podcast was the safe haven. The alternative media space and the information space online has really, I mean, they've certainly done a lot to try and suppress and dampen voices online. You've seen the attacks on Joe Rogan and Brett themselves, but they've survived, they've continued, and the attacks have actually only served to further interest in what they have to say and build a larger audience. So it's a sanctuary from the corporate-controlled media.
Yeah, so they came at me pretty hard.
Oh, yes.
And it's now being revealed, the mechanisms of that. Fascinating, a recent report out of Congress here in the United States that was released, you may recall that the BBC Trusted News Initiative was initially built to resist Russian and other foreign influence in elections. And then as all this took off, then they repurposed it, shutting down.
They became a lot more multifaceted, didn't they?
Just so. And at the same time, we had the launch of this new organization in our Department of Homeland Security called CISA, which is kind of the government hub for what's now termed the censorship industrial complex. And it's kind of the coordinating hub that all of these CIA and DIA and other instruments funnel their information into, and then it makes determinations, algorithmic and otherwise, about who needs to be censored for what.
Mm. So the Ministry of Truth, essentially.
Yeah, well, there was a real Ministry of Truth that was going to be set up, but that got so much blowback against Biden that they shut that down with Ian Jankowicz or something.
Yeah, they literally called it that, right?
Yeah, it was the singing... singing.
Yes. Oh my God. You've given me a horrific flashback. I didn't need to remember that.
Information laundering is really quite ferocious. It's when a huckster takes some lies and makes them sound precocious by saying them in Congress or a mainstream outlet. So disinformation's origins are slightly less atrocious. It's how you hide a little lie. It's how you hide a little lie. It's how you hide a little lie.
I'm probably triggering post-traumatic.
You're triggering a little. Certainly.
So in any case, that group then had a socket with the Stanford Internet Observatory, mm-hmm. which then had a bunch of private organizations that it was affiliated with that would screen and map disinformation as a part of this consortium that was set up. So you had CISA feeding into the Stanford Internet Observatory ecosystem, which then spat out actionable items to tech. And so tech, you know, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, the old Twitter, et cetera. And so that I got caught in that web, fascinatingly, just as they were before they transitioned it, just like the BBC did transition Trusted News Initiative, before they transitioned it from protecting election integrity. And I was one of the last ones that got caught in that, you know, at the end of the report, because the U.S. Congress doesn't want to talk about things that have happened. I always fall back, having been trained as an expert witness, one of the things that got beaten into my head by the lawyers was that I can't read minds and I shouldn't speculate about people's intent unless I had the documents. Okay. But in this case, what I was trying to get to with the story is the WHO and the U.S. government, and by extension, the Canadian government, because we have this lovely thing called the Five Eyes Alliance, this intelligence consortium. Was it overblown because of the financial agenda? Seems to be so conveniently merging with central bank digital currencies and global passports and digital IDs and all of this other stuff that is absolutely part of the globalist agenda. Was it just circumstance? They had these things on the shelf and they said, oh, we can use them for this too, because we have this huge crisis. Was it some mixture of all of those things? Were there bad actors that were exploiting this for financial and control purposes that, you know, seems to be so conveniently aligned with central bank digital currency and the Bank of International Settlements agendas, also so conveniently aligned with the World Economic Forum agendas, which, you're there in the UK. I think there's hardly a politician there that hasn't been captured by the WEF. You guys are pretty well.
Yeah, we're pretty deeply entrenched into that conglomerate.
Yeah, and you have a king who is one of the champions.
All fully for the Great Reset, and it's funny because
he
knows. Exactly. There's a disturbing lack of awareness on that kind of stuff.
So you asked the big question, which is basically, if I can paraphrase it, what the hell went wrong here?
Yeah.
And whether, you know, was somebody exploiting this for other purposes? I think it's pretty clear that this has been exploited for other purposes. Was it, the big question is, was it always intended for this from the outset? And there's a lot of this, you know, I've stayed away from things like the depopulation agenda, a lot of these things that I stayed away from the Great Reset for a long time. That was considered a conspiracy theory. And then I read Klaus Schwab's book called The Great Reset. And
yeah, which he puts out put out surprisingly early into the pandemic.
Yes, rather. Not particularly well written, but there it is. Came out early. And then I felt comfortable talking about it. I was, people even like Steve Bannon at first were telling me, oh, Robert, you're outside of your swim lane. Don't talk about these things. But now it's common knowledge. In, for instance, we at the Malone Institute, together with some researchers in Sweden, we published the definitive roster. It's an Excel spreadsheet of all of the World Economic Forum trained young leaders. So you can go there and look up the industry, the name, the country, where their current position is, all that stuff. They, as Klaus has bragged, they have infiltrated the government of Canada, yeah, in particular. Yeah. Canada, basically, they've captured Canada.
Yeah, I believe he said 50% or more of Justin Trudeau's cabinet have been captured by the World Economic Forum. He actually literally said, we have penetrated the cabinets, which is not something
rather,
to say
rather odd,
in...
odd language.
Yeah, very odd language. Odd. Yeah, very odd language.
When I mention our names, like Mrs. Merkel, even Vladimir Putin and so on, they all have been young global leaders of the World Economic Forum. Mm-hmm. But what we are very proud of now, the young generation, like Prime Minister Trudeau, President of Argentina and so on, that we penetrate the cabinets. So yesterday I was at a reception for Prime Minister Trudeau, and I would know that half of this cabinet, or even more half of this cabinet, are actually young global leaders of the World Economic Forum.
The big question of, well, what's the agenda here, is slowly being revealed. And I'm pedaling my little tricycle as fast as I can to try to get more of it into the mainstream. It doesn't help when people are busy talking crazy talk, because that makes it so that we can all be delegitimized.
Well, don't you think that's possibly being amplified by opposition as well? Because what better way to discredit you than by saying, well, look, he's associated with all of these QAnon, 5G, Bill Gates, you know, like people, and we shouldn't take that seriously. It feels to me that that's a very easy avenue for psychological warfare.
Disruptors that are promoting it, and they're coming from both sides. So there's also the ones that try to delegitimize me by asserting that I am deep state because of my history, and so you shouldn't listen to me because I'm one of the bad guys. And of course, my history of having created the platform technology is considered by many to be an automatic disqualifier, and it's strange. I once counted, there's at least 10 different ways I've been accused of being a mass murderer. Like many of us that have been subjected to the psyops, you kind of face a decision as time goes by. Are you going to run and hide with all the ugliness that they throw at you on a daily basis, and the character assassination inserted, you know, character assassination that's done? Are you going to go crawl in a hole, or are you just going to basically tell them to, you know, stick it where the sun doesn't shine and carry on? And I've chosen the latter. I'm comfortable with that. I can look at myself in the mirror every morning. My wife is still proud of me. And
I
have
to ask how family
people all over the world, thanking me. Go ahead.
I did want to ask how family and friends received your, you know, perspective and position on this, because obviously a lot of people across the world had entire breakdowns of the family unit just based on, you know, differences of opinion. So please, how was it for you with family and friends?
Varies. So yeah. I've absolutely destroyed my consulting business that I've run for decades with my wife. I'm persona non grata among my old colleagues in the Department of Defense, understandably. And I think some of them are on background in some of the attack pieces. I'm pretty sure I hear their voices in the Washington Post article in particular. But our children don't like us to talk about this, so I'm just going to park that. I live in here in Virginia, up against the Shenandoah National Park on a 45 give or take acre horse farm that we run. You know,
that sounds good for the soul.
It is very much, and although it's raining quite a bit today,
same here.
And it's a good thing we need to drink. And I'm in a purple state is the U.S. metaphor. In other words, it's mixed Republican Democrat. And in a very red county, in other words, I'm surrounded by farmers and a lot of conservatives, and they seem to treat me like a hero. I'm strangely, uncomfortably liked by the local police force. Makes me a little nervous. It's not the way most of my life has been.
Well, it's definitely better than being hated by the local police force.
Absolutely. And subjected to things like Steve Bannon gets subjected to living in D.C. It varies. You know, the good news is that the people that follow me on podcasts like this and know what I look like are generally not my haters. And my haters generally don't watch the podcast. And so when I walk in public through cities or airports, those that recognize me usually here are of the Dr. Malone, I'm so glad to see you.
Well, ones that have actually listened to you talk, ones that have taken the time to actually sit and listen to you, and haven't just, you know, read Rolling Stones magazine or the New York Times.
The receipts, the evidence to support this includes the World Health Organization Pandemic Treaty and International Health Regulation modifications.
Mm-hmm.
Remembering that the WHO has a cooperative agreement, basically a treaty with the WEF, that the second largest funder of the WHO is Bill Gates.
Yeah. WEF, by the way, for anyone listening, is World Economic Forum.
The vast majority, I think it's 70 or 80% of all the funding for the WHO comes from private parties, mm-hmm. which is a very gentle way of saying pharma. The WEF also has a treaty with the UN. WHO is just a branch of the UN. UN has Agenda 2030, which is a clear socialist manifesto.
Well, I wanted to briefly quote the former vice president of Pfizer, because I came across that quite recently. Major pharmaceutical company who had a leading role, obviously, in controlling the information flow during the pandemic, Dr. Mike Yeadon, who I'm pretty sure you've spoken to a number of times. But he said, and this is a quote for everyone listening, and this is the former vice president of Pfizer.
Unfortunately, I think this is just the beginning. So I've learned when people tell you what they're going to do, don't ignore them. So when the UN and Bill Gates and Klaus Schwab tell you that they've got a UN 2030 plan, with sustainable development goals, I think there are 17 or 21 of them, and every one of them says, you won't be traveling, you won't have a private car, we won't be using international shipping to move your goods around, there won't be any flights except military or perhaps very rich people, you won't own anything and you'll be happy, you probably won't live in your own house, you'll be using much less energy for everything, including heating, manufactured goods, and so on. When they tell you that, you should assume that they're serious about it.
Mike does have a tendency sometimes to go a little beyond the thin edge of the ice, as far as I'm concerned. And I don't want to disparage Dr. Eden or anything else, but sometimes he does draw conclusions that are a little far out. But the documents support that thesis, and at its core, Agenda 2030 can easily be looked up by anybody. It's a real thing. Agenda 2030 is considered to be a treaty by the United Nations. There is a clear effort by the UN to expand, let's say gently, its charter, which is supposed to be about mitigating the risk of war and improving equity globally. And they're way, way, way beyond that, deep in global governance, and clearly seeking a new world order of a centralized command economy with a single government that's basically modeled on the European Union. Remember that the EU leadership is largely unelected. Something that, with Brexit, those that are still fans of Nigel Farage would appreciate that that's not the system they want to live under. And Jay, beyond this, there is this new religion, and I think that's the appropriate term, called transhumanism.
Right.
And those that aren't familiar with the transhumanist agenda, I strongly recommend this new book called Dark Aeon, A-E-O-N. It's fairly easy read. As somebody who cut his teeth as a young man on the science fiction subgenre of cyberpunk, this reads like the near-term dystopian future of William Gibson and his colleagues, but it's here now, and they're pushing it as hard as they can. The logic that we are coming up against a singularity, something in the timeline of 2040, in which increasingly machines will run the world and humans will become largely irrelevant, is coming at us like a freight train. It's being actively pushed by these same players, big tech, Bill Gates, etc., that many of them actually do believe that they will be able to transfer their consciousness into the digital realm and thereby become immortal.
Yeah, this is the immortality key being sought.
Yeah, just so. You have Yuval Harari, who I think of more as a clown than anything. He intellectually packages stuff that other people have developed and then puts it out as the chief science officer of the World Economic Forum, with these books like Homo Deus, God Man, and the logic that religion is dead, and this fusion of man machine transhumanist future is we are now gods, and increasingly becoming so. And in this vision, this dark vision that many of us reject, that seems to underlie many of these agendas, is the belief that the actual belief that there should be a depopulation. We have too large of human habitation is compromising the world. It's very Malthusianism based. The logic that there are scarce, limited resources, and we need to reduce the number of humans that are consuming them, and that we are heading towards a future in which everything will be managed algorithmically using some version of machine learning or artificial intelligence, and humans will become to these new machine masters something akin to the relationship you have with your dog.
This is something
seems to be underpinning a lot of this.
This is something that I've definitely chewed over quite a bit over the last couple of years. And although I certainly don't subscribe to the globalist transhumanist agenda and any sort of dystopian picture being painted, I have chewed over this, and I'd be curious to know what your thoughts on this are, because if you look at human evolution all the way since the dawn of humanity, since the first time we hit a stone against a stone and made sparks, or sharpened a stick and turned it into a spear, we propagate technology. That's one of the things that we seem to do, is we create extensions, tools of our own influence. And we've been doing that in faster and faster increments, in more complexity, more sophistication as we progress through evolution. We're now at a point in the modern era where this hyper-acceleration of technology is giving birth to virtual reality and quantum computation and superconductors and now artificial intelligence. And I'm torn between whether this is a massive fuck-up and we've gone down the wrong road, and this is a road that's lined with self-annihilation of the species, or if this is in some way an extremely novel evolutionary element to our developmental story, because we are unlike any other creature on this planet, and we are the only ones that are capable of what seems to be, over history, building a catapult towards space, as if nature wants to go out and explore the cosmos, and perhaps it has cashed its chips into the human species. And so we're this very strange creature. So I'd be interested in getting your opinion on the hyper-acceleration of technology, because I've got a lot of friends in the AI space and the technology space, and there's all these different opinions coming towards me, and I just don't know if this is an evolutionary...
Yeah, there's kind of a split in the AI world right now between...
Absolutely.
We've gone too far.
Yeah.
And the, isn't this great?
Exactly.
We're all going to join...
It's the Star Trek... Yeah, the Star Trek future or the existential crisis, and both teams are, you know, kind of battling it out. So where do you sit on evolutionary versus a critical error being made?
So what you were framing up, the Dark Aeon book calls techne, T-E-C-H-N-E, that this body of technology that we are immersed in, the guitar behind your head, the glass window, your microphone, is something that almost has a will of its own. It craves and seeks certain things. One way to think of it is almost as if this body of techne that you're talking about has some sort of a will or driver. And whether that will is an organic vector sum emergent phenomena, or it reflects human desires or some mixture of those two, it is almost a tangible thing. And whatever's driving it, it has needs and wants. And I think this is kind of getting towards your idea of the nature wanting to launch something into the cosmos. Among those needs, obviously there's a drive to immortality, which is historic, probably has existed through the entire span of conscious human thought as we confront our mortality. These drivers towards technology being able to provide certain things, almost akin to the logic of an exoskeleton for humans, this
right
surrounding that we wrap ourselves in. And so we have this surrounding of stuff, this volume of information and capabilities. And at the core of it is this central processing unit with its flaws, its structural flaws, its input signal flaws. Remember, there's a whole other logic in this thought space that humans are fundamentally flawed evolutionarily because we have evolved information detection sensors and processing capabilities that are adaptive for our particular niche in the world to eat and procreate. And so we don't have really broad spectrum detectors. Our detectors are very limited in various ways. This can be easily proven. So we really don't know the nature of the cosmos. We can't directly perceive it. And then whatever data do come in, then get processed by this thing, and anything that's inconsistent with the model that this thing holds, it's rejected. Hey, so this is fundamentally flawed. And then there's then there's all this psychological baggage that we carry in our lizard brain and our ancestrally that has to do with conflict and envy and all of that, those human flaws that we have. And so isn't it better that we've had our time here, we've done our thing, we're reaching the limitations of this wet computer, and now we're giving birth to something greater that of course will displace it. It's akin to techne becoming a new species. And we're just a inconvenient step akin to a lungfish in this evolution of a transcendent consciousness that is immortal and will soon be able to propagate itself. And once it does, as was envisioned in you know, Blade Runner 2 was explored this space, right? Once those robots are able to, or those replicants are able to reproduce, then everything changes. Once these machine consciousnesses become autonomous, then wet humans become superfluous, and we actually become useless eaters. And so that's if you take that logic that you're touching on, the young wannabe gods of computational space seem to be so enamored of, they often advocate that this is a good thing, this progression towards these digital consciousness, autonomous, self-replicating machines, making human beings obsolete is a good thing. It's very wrapped up. For me, a lot of the problems here is that machine learning is not learning. And artificial intelligence is not intelligence. It can mimic intelligence. Does it have a soul? This is, do androids dream of electric sheep? Getting back to Blade Runner. You know, can we replicate something like a soul? Do these new digital consciousnesses?
Well, is there a need for replication? And what I mean by that is that you're kind of asking the question: does the caterpillar maintain a level of awareness of itself once it becomes a butterfly? Because if we're going through some form of metamorphosis, if we're in kind of a chrysalis right now and everything's breaking down and it's going to be rebuilt as this new iteration of consciousness, are we replaced or are we merged? Is there an assimilation? You know, is this a replacement? Are we the missing key? Are we the spirit? Are we the soul of the machine?
I'm just finishing up Dark Aeon, and it very much explores this space.
Yeah, yeah.
As did the cyberpunk genre. Mm-hmm. The thesis there that's being presented in Stark Vision is that there will be a branch of humanity, let's call them the Luddites, that refuse to accept whether they're neural implants or intravascular sleeves or whatever the tech is, or maybe they're just plain old nanobots, you know, and we all are you know, going to be part of the Borg collective. Another metaphor that's been well explored, the Borg for this vision that you're imagining, or the transition vision where you have organic life forms that are either willing to or are forced to submit to mechanical machine implant technology for our own good. So people, the paradox as you approach the singularity that you have to confront is, do you wish to remain human? Do you wish to create a neural interface or participate in a neural interface which would allow you to directly access the brilliant new sparkling future world of unlimited knowledge and memory directly? Or do you wish to somehow have whatever constitutes your consciousness loaded directly into the machine? Seems to be kind of the three scenarios. And
yeah.
In the scenario that there's this division in humanity, then those that don't accept the technology become less fit to compete in this new transhuman evolutionary race, because that's what it'll be.
Oh yeah,
Once, just because you accept Neuralink or whatever the thing is, that's going to be Neuralink 1.0, and you're never going to be able to catch up to this. You'll always be behind the cutting edge, and you will always have a digital elite, you will always have a stratified society. And those that don't participate for economic reasons or moral reasons will be forced into this position that, you know, the metaphor is that you're somewhere between a bacteria and a dog,
right?
Relative to the new digital masters that are set free because they no longer constrained by the limitations of biology, and they can go explore the universe.
But is this move towards assimilation, evolution, or error? You know, that's the question that I'm battling with.
I think it's a moot point. Mm. Okay, once,
because it's happening anyway.
In my experience, technology, once it's there, it will be. It will be used for whatever economic and power relationship purposes it can be used for. It will be weaponized.
Right.
And the history of the world being able to place boundaries on technology has not been a good one. I don't think there's an example where that succeeded. So it may be, the truth may actually be that we're busy arguing about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, and it's completely irrelevant because the angels will dance. And whether an infinite number of angels will dance on that pin whether we think that it should only be 256 or 364 that should be on the head of that pin. They will advance. And there's this unstoppable force, and the only thing that will halt it will be the ultimate currency, which is energy.
Right. Do you consider yourself spiritual at all?
Yes, increasingly so.
Increasingly so. Okay.
Yeah. Especially during the last, I always thought of myself as the methodical scientific materialist, I guess. Although, with a strange added component of Carlos Castaneda, acknowledging that there is a separate reality, that my framework has always been that the world can be divided into three spaces. Knowledge can be divided into three spaces: the known, the unknown knowable, and the unknown unknowable. That's how I've approached the world since I was a freshman in college. And we don't need to go too far beyond that in a public forum. But I did grow up on the central coast of California in the 70s.
Rock on, dude.
It's hard as one ages and you have these various odd experiences of coincidences that aren't really coincidences, sudden realizations of trauma or joy or something that happens at a distance with some other human. It's hard to square the circle there and just imagine this as a... The term scientism applies. It's actually misused, and I'm guilty of misusing it. Scientism being the belief that the only reality that exists is that which can be measured tangibly, physically. And that gets to my point of the limitations of human signal processing.
Yes.
Recognizing that there's all kinds of frequencies and wavelengths that we're completely stupid to. And even if we had those coming in at us, this central processing unit would probably reject those things that were inconsistent with our current model of what is reality, or we would go bad. There's something that binds us, and this gets to the point. This touches on the transhumanism as a religion and Homo Deus. What is God? Are we gods now? Have we transcended to more of a polytheistic world akin to that of Romans and the Greeks before the rise of Christianity? Are we those gods or are oligarchs those gods now? I don't think so. I hope not. I think there is something that binds us together that transcends the measurable scientific facts. So you asked me, there's a brief foray into that.
And do you think that has kind of in any way strengthened your resolve over the last couple of years in terms of dealing with what you've been dealing with? Sense of purpose, maybe?
So I do believe in the soul as a concept, in the need to maintain one's integrity. It's a big thing for me. And I guess the other day I saw Matthias Despot. I haven't spoken to him in a while, and he was there in Bucharest briefly, and he spoke about his new book. and about the importance of truth speech, that's speaking truth, that there's something fundamental in connection between humans when they are exchanging truths between them, as opposed to the subterfuge that's so often a component of human communication, when they're truly seeking to speak truth. He spoke at length on this, and I have tried really hard through this to stay grounded in truth and speaking from my heart and my mind of what I believe to be factual, fact-based information, and not allowing myself to veer off into speculative worlds. And I've come through this with all of the ugly stuff that's been thrown, feeling, you know, being pretty much intact, as comfortable with who I am. And I think that the having this long-standing monogamous partner, wife and I have been together, Dr. Jill Glasspool, and have been together since she was barely 15 and I was barely 16, and don't ask any more questions.
Wow.
So we support each other. You know, there's in the poems of the prophet, there's a discussion of trees having grown together and interwoven. I think that's helped both of us to sustain what has taken place here. And again, this gets back to, you know, in a transhumanist world, do you ever have that interdependency and connection?
Yeah.
Those things that give meaning and joy and pleasure in life. A case could be made that Bill Gates is certainly on the spectrum. Many people would call him a psychopath, but a person who doesn't have much in the way of empathy for others.
Right.
I don't want to be that person. You know, that may be a great path to enormous wealth. You don't have to worry about your conscience when you're dealing with others and seeking your advantage economically or otherwise. And so I guess that's a real strategic advantage if your goal is to become the richest person in the world. But is he a happy man? Is he lived a really good life? Is he surrounded by love? I don't know. Melinda bailed. And, you know, there's the whole Jeffrey Epstein, Lolita Express, and all of that. It just doesn't strike me that this is a person who is...
It doesn't scream happiness, does it? It doesn't scream.
No, it doesn't. And I made a decision to not seek to continue to climb the academic ladder and step back and build my own version of Galt's Gulch, if you're familiar with Ayn Rand's writing in Atlas Shrugged. This is, I guess there's more American fans of this than in the UK. This is very much rooted in the anarcho-capitalism of the new president of Argentina, the logic of the primacy of the individual and the sovereignty of the individual, and that the wealth of nations, the building of wealth and value is something that comes from the application of an individual man. I'm speaking for both genders. So he, him, she, they, I don't know what to say, but you get the point. I'm old school, so I'll just say the individual man applying his mind and muscle to the world, as opposed to the alternative vision of wealth, which is basically a violent one, that being you can take wealth from others that have created it. That's the in the anarcho-capitalism version of the state. The criticism of the state is that the state is parasitic. It doesn't create wealth. It only steals wealth from the others, and that wealth can be acquired either through your honest labors and efforts, or it can be acquired through theft from somebody who has engaged in those honest labors and efforts. I mean, you can take this into Marxism and the surplus value theory, right. But it's, I think many economists, they're arguing about the details, but in the end, it's the effort of the individual and the need for that individual to have the freedom to exert that effort rather than to function as an indentured servant to some other entity, such as one that would want us all to live in a world in which we own nothing and we're happy.
Mm. I think a lot of these guys, you know, I think about Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos, probably even Klaus Schwab. I always just kind of get a vision of a snivelly kid getting teased, picked on, probably a little bit geeky, maybe socially awkward, and didn't have much
careful there, cowboy, because I was that kid too.
No, don't take that as an insult.
The only reason I'm not wearing glasses is because I'm transhuman. In that I had my lenses replaced.
No, but the reason I say that is that I think that sometimes a certain psychology can develop.
I get your point.
Especially,
I'm just challenging you to be cautious with your stereotype.
And I appreciate that. I do appreciate that. It's always good to be challenged. And so I just think that there's a certain sense of, you know, like a kind of damaged male ego psychology that requires people to respect.
Psychology, these people that you're referring to are often not, I don't know about Jeff Bezos, but they're often considered to embody the dark triangle.
Right.
Of psychological characteristics, which includes Machiavellianism, narcissism, and a lack of empathy.
Right. And that makes you very successful in a cutthroat capitalistic world.
Yeah. And so that kind of merges into another whole school of thought, which has to do with the fourth turning, in right. which society has this historic trend where the psychopaths and the sociopaths come to dominate government and in industry. And then we all recognize that we've just allowed them to construct a new version of hell for us. I am kind of a fan of the logic that we each create our own heaven or our own hell during our lifetimes.
Right.
And I'll try to keep that in mind as I live my life. But a lot of these people are kind of dark triangle folks. I don't think that's a recipe for happiness personally. I had the experience in when I was at the Salk. I had come an epiphany there. I had seen the Salk as, you know, like the ultimate, that brutalist architecture, the ultimate embodiment of the ivory tower. I don't know if you've ever seen a picture of the Salk Institute, but it's a famous brutalist architectural. Yeah. Masterpiece.
I'm quite a fan of brutalism as an architecture. It's got a certain aesthetic appeal to me for some reason. I don't know if I grew up in a Soviet bloc in a past life or something, but
it's a little intimidating.
It's quite an intimidating aesthetic, no, for sure. It's just got a certain appeal to it for some reason.
And for some reason, often is associated with totalitarianism, but that's any case. So being there was like half a dozen Nobel laureates. including Francis Crick, who I always thought was a nice guy, occasionally talked to me over lunch. But in the rest of them, and then there was Jonas Salk. Jonas Salk was a very unhappy man. He didn't get the Nobel Prize. He didn't think that he got the attention and the recognition that he deserved. And I know for a fact that he was just a nasty piece of work with people that he thought were below him, common workers. And just really be rather rude. And among many of the others, there was a pecking order. Did you have to share your Nobel Prize? Oh, that wasn't nearly as important as what I did, you know. And the epiphany was that if you set your goal to strive, and the people that did this, that becomes consumed with the need to be recognized. And I believe a lot of it's relating to a drive. It gets back to the same thing. It's the drive for immortality.
Mm-hmm.
And they're seeking immortality through their scientific achievements, and they'll be in the history books.
Yeah.
They need to be recognized. They have to be acknowledged.
Well, that was one of the reasons Bill Gates cozied up to Epstein, was to get a Nobel Peace Prize. He wanted that Nobel Peace Prize.
So I don't know how that comes out of schlepping to Epstein Island, but...
No, but seriously, if you didn't know that, though, Epstein knew all of the people on the board of the Nobel...
Of course he did.
That's why, so he could, you know, a little whisper in the ear. Exactly. So that's why, that was one of the reasons. One of the reasons.
Yeah, so that's a whole other thread of what I think about Alinsky and the selection process. Something that I have... a personal interest in lately. But in any case,
yeah.
The point is, these people have a hole in their soul that they're trying to fill. And if that becomes your driver to obtain personal fulfillment through achievement, you can never achieve enough. I didn't see many happy, well-adjusted Nobel laureates. Maybe that's not the case with the Peace Prize, but with the Science and Technology Prizes, that seems to be the case. And I realized that this was you talk about a stairway to heaven, this is a stairway to hell. An unlimited, everlasting task that... consumes you until the moment that you die, causes people to neglect their families, their children, the world around them, and to often exhibit these sociopathic behaviors. I'm taught that the difference between a sociopath and a psychopath is a psychopath is born and a sociopath is learned, if you catch the point of suppressing empathy. But this leads people down a pathway that's not healthy, and it doesn't lead to happiness. And I'm kind of the opinion that this is a one-way street and we're all going to die, except for Bill Gates, who will be transferred into the metaverse. Where he will dominate humanity forever.
Fantastic.
But beyond that... Well, a lot of your buddies that you're talking about that are in that mindset,
dude. I'm torn.
This is the vision. You know, don't think that if you transfer your consciousness into the metaverse, that you're going to be one of the gods. I guarantee.
I mean, honestly, I'm not into the transferring of my consciousness. I'm a spiritual person. I think that we're already in some form of spiritual simulation. So I'm not ready for the Neuralink. I'm not going to be lining up for that. No, sir.
You're already in the Matrix.
I'm already in the Matrix. Yeah.
So I think that it's probably a good thing to be mortal.
And
to have a discrete end, and to, I think that contributes to sanity and focus. But for these, what I was trying to get out with these dark triangle people, and I got sidetracked. Psychologists, those that study these things, tend to define these people as not fully mature, that they're not adults, that they're not really fully human in the sense of what constitutes a fully baked adult human being. that they're somehow stunted in your metaphor of the golem-like, in the sense of Tolkien, personality that has these characteristics that modern psychology would support you in that, in that many of these people are that exhibit the dark triangle behaviors are not fully mature.
Right. Something damaged them, something stunted them, traumatized them.
Or sheltered them. I mean, that's another way that, you know, we have all these unfortunate young folk that have been coddled and helicopter parented, that were not allowed to experience the full thrust of the world and reality in all of its ugly, you know, truth, you know, the great joys and the great traumas. They're sheltered from that, and so they're not able to fully integrate a personality because they haven't been subjected to the stressors that will cause that integration. Which kind of loops back to your first point, you know, what's it been like to have all this stuff come at you?
Right.
And the truth is that myself and my wife in particular have grown enormously through the last 3 years and all the stress and things that we've been subjected to. It's the travel is a little rough, but we're absolutely different people than we were. It's now 4 years, by the way.
Wow.
Not that anybody's counting.
I lost count.
If we take the fall of 2019 as starting point.
Yeah.
So, you know, you mentioned that you're a person who views things through a spiritual lens.
Yeah.
And one way to accommodate the trauma that we've all experienced is to say that, well, maybe this has been for a good purpose. Maybe this is intentional. Maybe as a civilization, as individuals, as a culture, that we were all skating along on graphite rails, you know, and then suddenly we've had to confront some harsh realities.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the Dark Night of the Soul archetype?
No. Teach me.
Well, I think it's the Jungian approach. It's Carl Jung, I think, that kind of proposed the whole Dark Night of the Soul, and it's the idea of that necessary journey through the negative to arrive at a more developed and more sophisticated expression of who you are. So as a collective, I mean, I can certainly speak to, and I'm sure you can and everyone listening, as individuals, there are moments where your life collapses in some way, whether it be a personal relationship or a perception or whatever it may be. Life collapses, you panic, it all looks like it's going to stay like this forever, and then existential crisis, and then with some self-reflection, with enough time, enough distance from the event, you can start to realize how it benefited you. And I really like to think that that can then be extrapolated collectively to the species. And if I look at the way that the world is right now, in so many instances, we appear to be in a very dark night of the soul. And so my optimism has to say, well, from this chaos, there will come order, but we're just going to have to brace through a lot of turbulence right now. And who knows how long that might last.
I think that's really adaptive to look at things that way. To keep in mind that the other side of technology has historically been hubris. It's just the trajectory of the world is such that things may not play out quite the way that the current elite think that it's going to play out.
I actually think they're self-cannibalizing right now without even realizing it, drawing too much attention to themselves.
Well, there's that.
people are waking up.
That, you know, they, the globalist agenda, this belief that we should have, that it is very much grounded in utilitarianism and Malthusianism, is intrinsically almost predestined to crash. The logic that a centralized, globalized economy would only work if we had enough data points and good enough AI, which is the underlying thesis, is a thesis. You know, it's like what everybody says about communism. It's absolutely the best system in the world, and it's just that all of the prior attempts that have failed because they had this flaw or that flaw or that flaw or that flaw.
Yeah.
Likewise with centralized command economies, it never works. And one of the reasons is this gets back to Ayn Rand. I'm sorry, you're going to have to read Atlas Shrugged.
I promise.
Absolutely. But or the Mises Institute writings, which she was a big fan of, Ludwig von Mises, and his economic analyses. So in any case, this is the logic that it all comes down to the individual and the innovation of the individual, the insight of the individual, the labor of the individual, the creativity of the individual. And by individuals in her construct, we're largely talking about people that are fully human. The ones that are the true creators and innovators in the world, which is really what Atlas Shrugged was all about, is what happens if those abstent themselves from a bureaucratic world in which they're no longer welcome. The agendas that are being pursued, I think, are grossly naive. And grossly over-optimistic and very much self-serving. And it's only going to take a few critical failures, one of which is probably coming at us. The other day, in my essay this morning, I used the metaphor of a runaway freight train barreling at the DC Beltway, and that would be our runaway federal budget,
right,
and debt. And things aren't, everybody thinks the PRC is doing so great, but economically, not so much. They're overextended. It's only going to take one of these majors to default to set off a cascade that will sweep the world. And I don't know what's on the... That's the singularity that I think is coming at us before the digital singularity. I think it's the financial singularity. And I think it is starting to knock on the door a little bit. And I've heard it said probably the worst place to be right now is in the first world. Because we are going to have a really hard transition period. And a lot of the emerging economies are seeing this event, you know, the rise of the BRICS currency and a multilateral world, mm-hmm. as a really good thing for them. Remember, these are the ones that drive the UN, by the way. Here's a fun fact. The majority of UN nations are not actually democracies. Keep that in mind. That's who's being represented there. But, you know, that wants to have open borders and the right to immigrate wherever they want as a fundamental human right. So we're heading into something. I think the financial singularity is going to come before the digital one does. I think that this financial singularity is going to really impact on the digital one and may set that timeline back considerably, because those folks are living in a world in which they have basically unlimited finances.
Right.
That's not going to continue. And that you know, as I mentioned at the start, I just threw the one liner, the ultimate currency being energy. It's the availability of energy that will constrain what goes down here. And it may be that I keep looping back to Argentina because that was my essay this morning and what I've been diving into within this election. But the Latin American and African and some areas in Asia that have enormous resources that are underdeveloped and underexploited may be the best place to be as we move through the financial singularity, as opposed to the highly developed and interdependent first world, where if suddenly our cell phone service craps out, we're all wondering where we can get our cereal from. If suddenly the power grid goes down, most humans will be bereft within days.
You're essentially saying that we've been pacified over time to a point where we're not going to be able to deal with major change very well.
I guarantee the farmer in the high plains in Uruguay is hardly going to notice the difference.
No, they ain't going to be worried. It's just the laptop class and the intelligentsia of the Western world that are going to collapse under the weight of their own inadequacy as we journey into this technocentric future.
Fortunately, it's not just going to be the intelligentsia of the Western world. They're going to take down the common man.
Mm.
I mean, I was stunned. We went to a rally in Ireland. I've always had this mental image of Ireland as the land of the Celts. I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay. If you remember the skit,
I do know that skit.
That Irish battle hardened over decades of strife between Northern Ireland and the rest of the islands. And I go there, and they've all. Sorry, anybody that's listening from Ireland. I didn't see that culture. I saw a lot of people that were largely emasculated, indentured servants, with their country deeply in debt, and the British aristocracy still owning all the goodies.
Of course. I mean, it's like, obviously everyone needs to hear you saying it, but you do start to feel like a vending machine for the same sort of sentences. I understand. So, like, I'm glad that I could take you down some philosophical avenues maybe that you haven't done for a
while. I enjoy this stuff way more. I enjoy much more talking about philosophy and public policy. I spend a lot of time thinking about public policy these days.
Maybe we'll have to reconvene for a deep dive. But one thing I did want to bring up before we end this, because people were commenting about it on Twitter, was the, well, X now. Recently you posted on X saying that you'd seen data indicating that there have been...
And in these war games, they have people that are drawn from government, military, intelligence community, media, etc., mocking up as if they were a leader in that domain that they have expertise in. So somebody playing the role of the CNN reporter, somebody playing the role of the president, etc. In this, they envisioned a series of actions that should be taken to maintain order in the world, which included, I don't know how else to say it, very totalitarian, authoritarian actions that quite heavy-handed. You could take the clips from Australia early in the lockdowns with the police batons, and translated them almost directly into the stuff that they were talking about. Was it a way to build consensus? There was a representative from the CCP there. Was it a convenience for Bill Gates to gain insight into how the world would respond so that it could help guide his strategic investments? There's a lot of different ways you can slice this, but it absolutely happened. It's not a conspiracy theory. And it was amazingly accurate, let's say, is the most gentle way I could put it, in foreshadowing what actually went down. Have I covered that well enough?
I think you've covered that absolutely fantastically. And links can be in the description box below for anyone. I will put links for any of these source materials for anyone who does want to look into that a little bit deeper. Is there anything we haven't covered yet that you feel is important before we wind this down?
Oh, a bazillion things.
Well, yeah, we can go forever and ever.
The most important thing, so I always like to conclude any of these kind of deeper dives on a positive note.
Good.
One thing that I almost always conclude on these days is the importance of not allowing yourself to be victimized. Don't be a victim. There's a lot of different roles you can play. In a sense, we're all in the middle of the hero's journey. Either that or we're NPCs, if that acronym was used in the UK. So if we're not NPCs and we're real adult humans, we are all living through some form of the hero's journey, in which we will go through a period of trial and then come back with new wisdom. There are various forces that wish to position you as a victim. And on top of that, we have the whole victimization culture that seems to underlie wokeism. If I can go through what I've been through, okay, and still be a happy warrior and not be playing the victim card, you can too. And if I can withstand all of the character assassination attacks and, brutal stuff that has been thrown at me and my wife and so many people around me, and I'm still healthy, tanned, not depressed, not suicidal, and continuing to speak out, continuing to share truth as I see it, then you can too. You can withstand those things. So don't be a victim. You don't have to be a warrior. There's a lot of different roles you can choose, but make it a conscious choice. Say, this is what I'm going to be, this is the role I'm going to play. And don't let them force you into a role that you don't want to be in. So that's rule number one. Robert's rules. Don't be a victim. Choose to be a warrior if you want to. Only about 5% of people are typically warriors. It took 3 to 5% to run the American Revolution, so that 250 years later, we can get back to the same place again with oligarch rule and high taxation. But that's a tangent. So don't be a victim. You can choose to be a warrior if you do, or just choose to be honest with the people around you. Speak truth to those around you. That will help keep us from all going deeper into a totalitarian hellhole. That's the teaching of Desmet, is the way we get out of this, in part, is we have to seek to speak truth to each other. I also like to emphasize that the precondition that got us here, that enabled the propaganda to be so effective against us, was the fragmentation of society and the isolation of the individual. And an observation that many of us have made as we toured the world is that communities of faith and people that have maintained strong communities have been among the most resilient and the most resistant to the weaponized propaganda and weaponized fear that we've all been subjected to. One of the key things that happened here was a profound disregard for human dignity. The failure to provide informed consent is a failure to respect human dignity. So again, the three things that I repeatedly focus on in closing is not only don't allow yourself to be a victim, suggest you choose to be a warrior, but at least speak truth. But keep these three words that have been my guide, my lodestones through all of this in mind. Integrity, the lies and the propaganda is a failure of integrity. Dignity, the disrespect of your fellow man and yourself has been an assault on human dignity. Community, the thing that will get us through this is by rebuilding our associations with each other, by rebuilding and embracing human community. It's what gives joy to our lives. It's what makes us whole. It's the thing that we're not going to get in that techno-fascist world that they seem to want to thrust us into. So integrity, dignity, community, don't be a victim, speak truth, go forth, and live long and prosper.
Dr. Malone, I want to thank you for showing the courage you've shown to stand up against a tirade of resistance from very powerful institutions, constant attacks against you from the corporate media machine. You are a warrior. I respect you tremendously. I wish you the very best of luck with your mission. Would love to keep talking to you. Would love to philosophize a little bit more if you have time somewhere down the line. And I'd just like to say again, thank you for taking such a sufficient amount of time to kind of outline all of this for everyone. And I think it'll be greatly appreciated by my audience.